and design the whole house. It seems a miracle to her that this could truly be hers. Heath has grilled a tuna he's caught in the Gulf of Mexico and seasoned with piquant salsa. Jackie, Heath, their two children, and I sit down, pray, and enjoy the delicious fish. Heath describes the time he was out deep-sea fishing in the Gulf and, from a great distance, watched the fire of the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon explosion. He had considered the possible effects of the oil and dispersant on his catch there, but figured it was minimal. Jackie rises from the table to fetch a children's sporting magazine that features their beaming 10-year-old son, Christian, hoisting high a large, dangling yellowfin tuna. The family loves fishing, hunting, and the outdoors, Jackie tells me. After lunch, Jackie and I move to the living room, and the topic gravitates to her gratitude to Jesus. The Lord has given her all she treasures, she feels. A loving husband, two beautiful children, frisky dogs, and the chance to stay home with her children in a beautiful, all-paid-off home. The American dream. Set in the affluent suburban development of Cortland Place on the outskirts of Lake Charles, with a double brick pillar entrance, hers is an earth-toned house bordered by azaleas and daisies, with an American flag draped over a large stone on the neighbor's side of their driveway. Weekday afternoons, the neighborhood is empty except for homemakers and an occasional black gardener edging hedges with an electric trimmer. A successful contractor, Heath has built and repaired houses in the aftermaths of hurricanes Katrina, Rita, Gustav, Ivan, Matthew, and Bertha. If Louisianans measure time in storms, Heath measures it in ripped-off roofs, broken windows, flooded basements, and jobs to do, if only he could find enough good workmen for his crew around town. I came from nothing. The very first words Jackie said to me when I first met her at a Tea Party focus group in Lake Charles were, "I came from nothing." Growing up, there was so much she had wanted and so little she could have, including loving attention. Along the way, she had learned a subtle lesson about managing strong wishes and the counterintuitive effects of doing so. Sometimes it's wise to give up wanting something very badly, she felt. In his mysterious way, the Lord may ultimately grant your wish. Like some others I spoke with in Louisiana, Jackie felt she had hold of an American dream, but maybe just for now. Gesturing around her large living room, she says, "This could all vanish tomorrow." She had worked hard. She had waited in line. She'd seen others cut ahead, and this had galled her and estranged her from the government. Like Janice Areno, Jackie had developed a deep story self. She could accommodate the downside of the free market, and sadly that included the bad news of industrial pollution. But she had her own way of doing so. Jackie has brought me coffee, and we are sitting alone in her living room to talk. She loves nature, she tells me. While Janice Areno, brought up close to nature, had focused on the fish she caught, the deer she shot, Jackie had grown up in Chicago, had never fished, hunted, or even much got to the zoo. Ironically, when I brought up the topic of environmental pollution to Janice, she conceded that it existed and quickly moved on. But Jackie herself raised the topic and expressed her distress about it. "I saw a little boy swimming in Lake Charles last week. They should have warning signs up. What if that boy accidentally swallowed some water? He was diving. It's easy to do. It breaks my heart," she says. She feels the same about chemicals in the air and soil, and wishes, all things being equal, that for the health of her family, they could move. So how, I wonder, did someone who so deeply appreciated nature, who did not avoid knowledge of injuries done to it, end up celebrating industry and the unrestrained consumption of all it produced. How did she, too, live the deep story? Much of the answer began, as for us all, in childhood. On a snowy March day in 1990, Jackie was 19, jobless, homeless. She lay in the corner of the unvacuumed living room floor in her younger sister's apartment, beside her sister's dog. I had no address. I'd found work behind a hotel front desk in Dallas, then as a land title researcher for a contractor. I did well in a series of jobs, but I felt lost, kicked out, angry. My entire belongings fit in a suitcase. After my stepdad kicked me out, my sister was the only one I could turn to. She took me in. I'd been in her apartment 6 weeks and I was treating her horribly, Jackie recalls. I had two jobs, and when I wasn't working, I was in my pajamas, smoking and drinking. While my sister was at work, I'd let the dishes pile in the sink, run up her phone bill, and let the house stay a mess. I lied. Every day I wrote a list. I will not lie. I will save my money. I will stop drinking. I carried the list in my pocket everywhere I went. I meditated on it. Then got halfway through the day, then quit. I felt dead. I was shattered, broken. I had come from nothing, and I was heading for nothing. Jackie had been born the third of five children to an Irish Catholic homemaker and an abusive, alcoholic father who left when Jackie was eight. My mother had to get on welfare to support us, she says. She defends welfare for mothers in such situations, though she feels they are a small proportion of those on it. My mother got a job, then two, then three. We never took our problems to her. She had enough on her hands. Eventually, Jackie's mother remarried and followed her new husband to Louisiana. While their mother worked, the girls discovered their stepfather to be a dirty-talking sexual predator. But Jackie stood up to him. They quarreled, and her stepfather announced that if Jackie left home, she could never return. At 19, high school diploma and suitcase in hand, Jackie stepped out the front door of her home into what felt like an emotionally empty world. Later rescued by her sister, still lost, she underwent an experience that was to transform her life. Her sister was at work. Out the window it was a beautiful bluebird day, Jackie recalls. And lying on the floor with her sister's dog, Jackie had a moment of transformation. I looked up at the sky and said, "If you really save people, Jesus, would you save me? I can't save myself." Then I got up off the floor. I had no idea what I was doing. I walked into the bathroom and looked in the mirror at a completely different girl. That was it. How did that different girl look, I ask. Clean, beautiful. I believe that for the first time, I saw in the mirror how he saw me. He showed me who I am to him. Everything, her marriage to Heath, her children, her living room with the graceful stone fireplace and a spacious house, all are testimony, she feels, to that moment. Abraham Lincoln was a very good man. I revere Abe Lincoln, she muses. But if Lincoln walked down the road, he wouldn't see me. Jesus would see me. Presidents? You can't see them and they don't see you. But Jesus is always there, she feels. And she had learned from him how to trust to him that good things would happen. Wishing too hard for things could even be counterproductive. I started to learn the Bible, and it said that those who wait on the Lord will mount up on wings like eagles. They will run and they won't grow weary. She pauses. Those who wait. So that means when everything's right, things will happen. We don't necessarily have to make things happen. Curiously, though, Jackie greatly admires her mother, who did make things happen. As an abandoned mother of five, on welfare, her mother had first found a low-paying job in Chicago's Flower City. But you know how my mother got her first good job as a medical secretary? She went to the library, studied what medical secretaries do, got all dressed up, applied for the job, lied that she had a college education, and got the job. She did well and ended up years later as an account executive in a large advertising agency. Jackie laughs with delight. They don't teach that kind of gumption in college. Though highly enterprising herself, Jackie was following a different path, at least for now. Sometimes you have to manage your strong wishes. Then something good happens. You win a protective husband, enjoy a paid-off house. Reward for renunciation. Having related this story, Jackie suddenly asks, "May I take you on an adventure?" We climb into her tan SUV, move her children's jackets and tennis shoes to the back seat, and drive past the double brick pillars of Cortland Place, past an empty field, out the main road, past strip malls, and into a modest housing development. She slows to a stop in front of a snug, one-story townhouse in a pan-flat neighborhood of similar homes encircled by modest, trim lawns. It was their first home, Jackie says. She and Heath had lived there for 8 years when the children were small. Their neighbors were refinery operators, bartenders, machine repairmen, and cashiers from the three enormous casinos in Lake Charles. Many worked long hours, emptying the neighborhood of company. "We didn't get to know our neighbors, but the kids could ride their bikes," she says, pointing to a nearby cul-de-sac. Jackie drives on for another 10 minutes through other neighborhoods of brick homes hedged with modest shrubs until we arrive before a second home. "We built our second house in Pine Mist Estates and paid it off in 3 years," Jackie says. I snap a photo out the car window of an attractive red brick ranch house with white trim and three mid-sized palm trees, their fronds gracefully arching over the front. We'd seen two former houses. What was this adventure, I wonder? Jackie goes on. "When we lived in Pine Mist Estates, I always wanted to live in Autumn Run," Jackie says. After we circle through another mid-scale development, there it is, a third house, the one she used to dream about when she lived in Pine Mist. It, too, is a one-story ranch house set on a treeless corner lot, larger than the first, but not as large as her present home. House 3 was bigger than House 2, but it was the house she didn't dare want. Jackie had learned to be an obedient Christian wife, to subordinate her wishes to those of Heath. Having witnessed her mother's two disastrous marriages, she wanted a good marriage to Heath, and it seemed to her that the route to this was to act as Eve did to Adam. She would be as a rib to Heath, a helpmate. But this presented a conflict. "I wanted that house so badly," she repeats, staring at the object of a once powerful desire. "But I never breathed a word about wanting this house to Heath. We couldn't afford it. He was working so hard. I didn't want to pressure him. I was ashamed of wanting it when there was no way we could have it. He's never even known I wanted to live in Autumn Run so bad. But look at it now." The house's roof is ripped, the paint is chipped, the fence sags, the lingering signs of the highly destructive Hurricane Rita. "Now the kids call it Autumn Run Down," she tells me. We have seen House 1, the starter house, House 2, a slightly larger house, and House 3, her old dream house. And now we are headed back to House 4, her own beautiful house. Jackie wants me to know something about her relationship to House 3, her old dream house. She had wanted it too badly. "I always dreamed of living in Autumn Run," she says again. Jackie wants me to see this talisman of desire, this proof that it isn't wise to wish for something too hard. Her once coveted house is nothing compared to the home she lives in now, which is beyond my wildest dreams. The home paid off in 3 years when I couldn't imagine less than 30. I told my daughter, what if I had pushed to move to Autumn Run? We would have ended up there when this, our current house, is the house we're meant to be in. I told her that Bible passage about not necessarily having to make things happen. Each house was as a step on a ladder to the American dream. On one rung, she had yearned too much for the next. That was the lesson. In a sense, Jackie's lesson ran counter to the deep story. One shouldn't wish too much for what seems like the next step toward the American dream. That was grabbing. On the other hand, she had struggled hard emotionally not to grab for it. Our adventure was in coming to understand that lesson. On our ride back to her home, Jackie gestures out the window. "See over there? That's Crestview. This is another housing development where dream houses 5, 6, and 7 might be," she is pointing out. "This is where super rich people live." Then she adds, "I've never even driven there. I don't want to. I don't want to want a house there." It was hard enough wanting these other things she felt she couldn't have. As we drive home, she reflects, "I was a poor little Irish girl. I was devastated that I didn't have a good home life like everybody else did. I mean, some of my friends were rich kids who ended up going to lovely Ivy League colleges. In Chicago, we lived on the other side of Elliott Road. Everyone on our side of Elliott Road was poor. We looked nice, so you couldn't see that we didn't have anything." She so envied the girls on the other side of Elliott Road, with their happy families, their lovely homes. It had been a struggle to give up wanting what they effortlessly enjoyed, but with Jesus's help, she'd given it up, and her own beautiful house was his reward. The reward for renunciation appeared to her in another way, too. Although a born-again Christian, Jackie was reluctant at first to follow her husband into the Baptist church, and even more reluctant to tithe 10% of their hard-earned wages to it. "And that's on top of the 33% taxes we pay the government," she notes. There was the house note to pay, the children's private Christian school tuition, hurricane and health insurance payments, car insurance, gas, and 10% on top of that. How could they swing it? Then more. Trinity had a fundraising campaign to renovate and expand the building, for which the church was asking all parishioners to commit an extra $3,000. At first, Jackie thought, "We can't." Then 37, Heath was earning $18 an hour in his father's construction business, and his father shared a third of his profits with Heath as well. But Heath had signed a pledge to Trinity Baptist. And as a dutiful Christian wife, Jackie renounced her wish to pay off their debt. If she renounced one wish, she'd discovered, a bigger one came true. As Hurricane Rita shredded homes, upended trees, and smashed houses, Heath got more work and earned more money. People living in fifth-wheel, towable trailers got him to rebuild their homes. Heath was also asked to put in the drywall for Trinity's children's playroom and gym. "Even though we were tithing and giving the church $3,000, we paid off every loan," Jackie said. In every job she has taken, Jackie explains, "I always end up the leader. I'm good at it." But on accepting Christ as her Savior and joining Trinity and becoming a Christian wife, she had renounced her wish to lead. A wife is a helpmate to her husband. Eve was created to be a helper. I'm created to help Heath. By renouncing one desire, Jackie fulfilled another. She got to stay home with her children. We have turned around now and are slowly driving back through this parade of neighborhoods to her home in Cortland when the issue of environmental pollution comes up. We live in a terribly polluted environment here, Jackie tells me. My son's best friend, Patrick, recently died of a rare neuroblastoma at age 9. 9? That young? His parents think some chemical around here caused it, but they can't prove it. On the campaign trail, in the media, from the pulpit, and from industry, I had observed a silence about pollution. It seemed like the kind of amnesia E.E. Evans Pritchard had spoken of, the kind that had led the Areno family to remember the events on Bayou Din in a spirit of defiance. This silence extends to Jackie's personal world as well. Pollution? I don't talk about it much with friends, Jackie muses. This whole town operates off of oil. So I could be talking to two moms whose husbands work in the plants. They think government regulation will hurt jobs or stop new plants from coming in. You don't want to remind them of dangers or make them think you're blaming them for the work they do. It's too close to home. Again, the silence. Many plant workers were indeed caught in a bind. As enthusiastic members of the Calcasieu Rod and Gun Club and lovers of wildlife, they feel remorse about pollution. But as employees, they felt obliged to keep quiet about it. And so, out of deference, did Jackie and Heath. One consultant told me he saw a notice in the men's room, "Don't drink the water," in Axial, this being the former PPG. But you don't hear much talk about why that sign was there. Jackie was a worshiper. She had developed a worshipful attitude and a capacity for meaningful renunciation. Instead of overcoming her aversion to regulation, Jackie spoke of learning to live without it. In this way, she echoed team loyalists like Janice Areno. You accommodate. Clean air and water, those were good. She wanted them, just as she wanted a beautiful home. But sometimes you had to do without what you wanted. You couldn't have both the oil industry and clean lakes, she thought. And if you had to choose, you had to choose oil. Oil's been pretty darned good to us, she said. I don't want a smaller house. I don't want to drive a smaller car. An operator job in an oil plant is a passport to houses in Pine Mist. One of those rare engineering jobs gets you into Autumn Run, and a high management job gets you into Cortland. The Arctic Cat, the SUV, the house, all these, she felt, came indirectly from oil. For its part, the federal government got in the way of both oil and the good life. As a team loyalist, Janice Areno had not allowed herself to feel too badly about pollution. Bayou Din, the rubberized horse. As a loyalist to industry and the Republican Party, she defended herself against too much anxiety about pollution, the brown pelican, and human health. For her part, Jackie Tabor allowed herself to feel sad about these things. It was a terrible shame this had happened, she felt. But having permitted herself to feel sad about environmental damage, she renounced the desire to remediate it, because that would call for more dreaded government. Each had a different moment of emotional pause. Janice's was on the act of admitting to loss and grieving it. Jackie's important moment of emotional pause was upon the act of renouncing an important desire. A clean environment? Sadly, we can't have it. I'm named for Jacqueline Kennedy, she says, her face ready to receive my surprise, and she admires the Kennedys still. But today she feels, as in the deep story, that the government has gone rogue, corrupt, malicious, and ugly. It can't help anybody, she says. Like others, she feels that President Obama is not a real Christian, and, neither through his upbringing nor in his loyalty, a true American. Her distrust has gone the full cascade, from president to the redistributive function of the federal government to nearly all government functions, including that of cleaning up the environment. Along the way, Jackie goes out of her way to explain that she does not admire those who pay their taxes gratefully. She doesn't feel grateful for what the government does for her and doesn't believe others should either. In a lightly taunting way, she brings up the financier Warren Buffett. He's rich, and he says he wants to pay higher taxes because that's fairer to poor people. Buffett had said that he didn't think it fair that his secretary paid higher taxes than he did. Okay, set the standard, Jackie taunts. What's stopping you, buddy? Write that check if you don't think you pay enough taxes. Get on TV, the whole world will cover it, and be a hero from one end to the other. Knock yourself out. Why aren't you writing a check? Jackie speaks with frustration. Buffett seemed to be asking for praise for being a good citizen in a system she no longer believes in. He was on offer as a role model for a liberal gratitude for public schools, libraries, and parks, but those were liberal-feeling rules, not hers. I'm not against stopping pollution, of course. I'm for regulating polluters, Jackie says, but she quickly amends what she said. I would be all for it if the government didn't use pollution as an excuse to expand. And environmentalists are not to be trusted either. They push the government to expand and have their own financial interest in solar and wind, too. What she holds separate from this betrayal and pursuit of self-interest are the Constitution and the American flag. On another visit, I come with Jackie to a performance at her son's small Christian school. Sitting near us in the audience are Jackie's kindly mother-in-law and her mother-in-law's mother. Christian steps to the front of the assembled parents, asks them to stand, reads a passage from the Bible, asks them to be seated, and is followed by students who one by one do the same. As part of their performance, a video is shown and America the Beautiful is played. Looming high and majestic on the screen, backlit by a vivid sunset, the American flag waves.
Take a picture with your cell phone, Jackie whispers, of the flag.
The American government is a betrayer, she feels, but the American flag stays true. Liberals seemed a problem for Jackie because they believed different things and might get her children to believe them too. As we drive home from the performance, the children in the back of the SUV, she shakes her head, recalling an incident. My kids were watching a program called Victorious on the Disney Channel, which I thought would be fine. But the commentator started to talk about global warming. We don't believe in global warming. That belief, too, seemed like an excuse for government expansion, part of the betrayal. The commentator said that people that watch Fox News are idiots. It was a good thing I was watching TV with the kids and caught that. I thought, how long are my kids going to believe me over them? A year? 6 months? Jackie's impulse to clean up the environment had also been tempered by her faith. I'm probably less an activist than I would be because of my faith today, she says. As a kid, I wrote every president to tell him what I thought he needed to do. But now, I'm less involved. I do think a lot of activists are self-serving. You have to put up with things the way they are. She has a deep story self. She had fought her way out of a tough childhood to the front of the line for the American dream, a line in which she feared her family could lose its place. Meanwhile, as we drive past the American flag draped over a stone at the edge of her neighbor's yard, into the carport beside the Arctic cat, With a small, sad shake of her head, Jackie says, "Pollution is the sacrifice we make for capitalism." 12. The Cowboy, Stoicism. A Vidalia onion sits within arm's reach of Brother Cappy's place at the dining room table. A warning, half joke and half serious, not to fight. Around the table, some 10 people are seated for Sunday dinner at the home of Brother Cappy and Sister Faye Brantley, two respected elders of the Pentecostal Church in Longville, an hour's drive north from Lake Charles. Mike Tritico is their friend, and he has asked them if I could join. Everyone has come from either that church or the local Baptist one, and everyone knows about the onion. Debate between two men, regular luncheon guests, and friendly adversaries is about to begin. It is both Poke in the Ribs' home theater, a source of collective hilarity, and an airing of serious political difference. The onion is Cappy's standing joke, a way of saying, "Keep it civil, boys." Arguments could get heated over anything to do with the environment, regulation, and the government. A fatherly man with half-moon eyes and thinning reddish hair, Brother Cappy is a well-liked retired telephone repairman. Before coming to their house, I had attended the Longville Pentecostal Church with the Brantleys. Brother Cappy had spoken at church, introducing the man who reported the attendance, 38 parishioners, and the total collection, $42.45. His wife, Sister Faye, wearing a long floral dress and pale-rimmed glasses, her gray hair swept into curls high on her head, had sung gospel tunes with zest in church, and now warmly welcomes us into their cozy home. One by one we pass the bird feeders and flower beds, climb the front steps onto the front porch, pass the wooden swing where neighbors gather over coffee in the morning, and scatter a plump calico cat. The Brantley home is part of a larger family compound. "Our family all live right here," Sister Faye explains proudly. "Our daughter and family here," she points left. "Our son and family there," she points right. "My 91-year-old mother lives behind us." They have with them the Brantleys' cousin, who is in training to become a Pentecostal minister, and their son-in-law, an inspector at Certain Teed.
"And Brother Cappy and Sister Faye have adopted us," Mike Tritico adds brightly, referring to himself and another Sunday dinner regular, a retired repairman of railroad tracks and bridges. "So they've got a big family."
Cappy and Mike had long been friends, and Cappy and another parishioner at the Pentecostal church had done a faith healing that cured Mike's back of terrible pain for 12 years, Mike said, which further deepened their bond. Beyond Sunday dinners, friends also gather most mornings to sit on the porch, drink coffee, gossip, and talk politics. Three young women, the Brantley's daughter, daughter-in-law, and granddaughter, a freshman at McNeese University, have stayed back from church to prepare steaming roast beef, gravy, potatoes, okra, green beans, cornbread, and sweetened iced tea. They would catch the full gospel service later that evening. They have set two tables, one for the women, smaller, in the kitchen, and one for the men, larger, in the dining room. The two sexes normally ate at separate tables, but Mike has asked the Brantleys if it would be okay for me to sit at the men's table so I can listen in on the weekly debate between him and Donnie McCorkadale. And that's the man I'm eager to meet, a retired telephone company worker who hates regulators. Donnie is a lanky, blonde, fit man in his 60s, dressed in slacks and a blue shirt, slightly slouched in his chair, quiet. He is, Tritico tells me, the younger son of a highly religious mother, well known as a Baptist prayer warrior. When Donnie was growing up, Like some other devotees in Maryville, his mother was said to wear long dresses, have uncut hair, and occasionally switch young girls for immodesty. Perhaps rebelling against such strict rules, Donnie grew up as the playground prankster and daredevil. Now on his second marriage, Donnie is raising a young family, including two children, one an adopted boy from Honduras. Known for spontaneous acts of kindness, he once saw Tritico at a church yard sale eyeing a $25 wooden organ he could not afford. Donnie handed money to the seller, hailed a handyman with a dolly, and paid him to deliver the organ to Tritico's cabin. Missing a key or two, and emitting an occasional hum, the organ sat for decades in Tritico's disheveled cabin, a reminder of Donnie's good heart. A former Democrat, Donnie voted for Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush because,
"If Al Gore believes in climate change, he's too stupid to be president."
Since then, he had moved to the right of the Republican Party. A story about Donnie had long circulated around Longville, and heads always shook in disbelief at the retelling. Like Cappy, Donnie had long worked for the phone company, and both men drove repair trucks. One day, as Cappy was driving his truck 60 miles an hour on the freeway, he heard a honk, glanced out his truck window, and was flabbergasted to see Donnie driving his truck alongside him, as legend has it, also 60 miles an hour, in reverse. Donnie was also known for secretly sticking pins in co-workers' styrofoam coffee cups to make them dribble inexplicably. He has logged forests, worked the Alaska pipelines, handled electrical wires atop telephone poles. Dangerous jobs. He also exceeds speed limits and hates environmentalists.
"They talk pollution to death."
If Janice Arino came to endurance through a loyalty to her team, the Republican Party, and Jackie Tabor by expressing a religious attitude of renunciation, Donnie came to it through a celebration of daring. He is a cowboy. With loaded plates, everyone seats themselves and says prayers. Brother Cappy is seated at the head of the table. Donnie and Mike Tritico sit to each side of him, across the table from each other. Both Donnie and Mike are white, church-going residents of Longville, neighbors and friends on opposite sides of an issue. They both value honor and integrity, but there are key differences between them. Although mentally unstable, Mike's mother graduated from college, and Mike himself got 3 years into a medical degree and 2 years into a master's in marine biology before dropping out. Donnie's parents are not college-educated, but Donnie headed into a forestry degree for a while before moving on. The two men start to talk about the Lake Charles EDC leak discovered in 1994 in the pipe between Condia Vista and the Conoco docks, the largest toxic chemical spill in U.S. history. As I noted earlier, Condia Vista had hired 500 cleanup workers to remove soil containing EDC from beneath the 40-year-old pipeline, part of the estimated total of between 19 million and 47 million pounds spilled. Workers were not given adequate protective gear, and by the late 1990s, many had begun to have trouble breathing and had sued Condia Vista. But the problem had not ended there. An underground plume of EDC had penetrated the clay and was slowly moving toward the pilings of the enormous I-10 bridge, which daily carries 50,000 vehicles between Lake Charles and Westlake. Madonna Massey had said the I-10 bridge was spooky. Jackie Tabor avoided it. Others, too, spoke of it as strange, without mentioning the EDC leak. Guests have risen, refilled their plates, and reseated themselves expectantly. And a debate between Donnie McCorkadale and Mike Tritico over the EDC leak under the I-10 bridge begins. The I-10 bridge.
For the first time, the State Highway Department is talking about closing down the I-10 without building another bridge, Tritico begins. They can't dig down to bedrock because of that spongy EDC-soaked clay. That tells you that they, the mayor of Lake Charles and city engineers, understand the danger. It's reasonable to be scared of the bridge and to wish there had been better oversight.
Tritico is guided by the precautionary principle, the principle he returns to over and over in debates with Donnie.
It's the principle doctors abide by. First, do no harm.
And to apply it to the I-10, you need good government, he feels.
Don't jump on the company, Donnie fires back. They didn't know their pipe was leaking. They didn't realize that this was going to happen 40 years back when they put the pipeline in.
Mike,
they can't say they didn't know in the 1970s what EDC would be doing to our clay today. Candia Vista and Conoco knew that EDC would ruin clay, because the industry conducted two different studies where they put the EDC into the local clay and it ruined it.
Donnie,
they weren't convinced. Why would they believe these experts? Just because some expert tells you X is true doesn't mean X is true. You know, if you're making $1 million a day on something and somebody wants you to stop it, you don't say that's the truth until you're really convinced it's the truth. I wouldn't have believed it.
Mike,
companies contrive ignorance. They were saying, I'm going to believe what I want to believe, even if you do give me scientific evidence. They didn't react to information their own experts gave them.
Donnie,
experts can be wrong. You remember in 1963 when the seatbelt law hit? I had a Pontiac that had a lap seatbelt, and I'd sit and wear it. The Chevys and Fords didn't have them. GMC trucks had a seatbelt, so some people believed it was a good thing, and others didn't. And later on, the regulators concluded that the lap belt wasn't the answer. So we'd all agreed to a silly regulation.
Mike,
if Candia Vista and Conoco want to hide their heads in the sand and not admit that EDC could break up clay underneath the I-10, then later, when they're found responsible, they should have to pay.
Donnie,
you can't always be ready to blame the company like those lawyers are all set to do.
Mike,
but what if it is their fault and it's your bridge? Suppose you're in the car and the bridge collapses because the clay is spongy. Then suppose you die, okay? Your family will say, wait a minute. The company knew they were wrecking the clay.
Donnie,
you want everything to be perfect, for companies to make no mistakes, and you and we can't live like that. If you aim for perfection, then you're being overly cautious, because we have to be able to take risks. That's how they split the atom, risk. That's how they made vaccines, risk. They were daring. A lot of good things happened because people dare to take risks. With all these environmental regulations, we're being too cautious. We're avoiding bad instead of maximizing good. To live in civilization, you've got to take risks. There will be mistakes. You can't succeed by just always being perfect. People have to learn from their mistakes. We wouldn't have made the discoveries we have, live with the world of plastics we've got, car steering wheels, computers, the telephone wires I deal with, a lot of that's plastic. We wouldn't have built this country if we were all as risk-averse as you are. Do we want to go back to life in shacks reading by kerosene? Accidents happen. They used to spill kerosene, so what? Do you wish they had never used that?
Mike,
no one's talking about going back to kerosene or never making mistakes.
Donnie,
regulation is like cement. You lay it down, and it hardens and stays there forever.
A ripple of laughter circulates around the circle. The women now seat themselves around the men's table. Donnie, continuing,
once something is regulated, it's hard to unregulate it. And so, year after year at first, It's just a little at a time, but then, after a while, it's like it is now, hardened cement. Everything is regulated. We're all stuck in cement.
The conversation turns toward the overregulation of playground fights.
Children have a natural desire to dominate and try to get what they want, Donnie says. It only stops when one guy is afraid his lip is going to get busted. That's the natural order. Regulation breaks that up.
We don't see the harm overregulation can do.
Mike, I'm not talking about regulating everything or avoiding all mistakes. I just don't want us to make certain kinds of mistakes. The kinds that spill chemicals into water and give people rare brain cancers and endometriosis, or that lead innocent people to drive on collapsing bridges and die. Children, too. Why let that happen if there's a known way to prevent it?
Donnie,
I think we all have to take our knocks, sadly. We all make our own independent decisions. With its overload of regulations, the government is almost living our lives for us. You're not you anymore. You're it.
Mike,
so if you're driving the car on the I-10 of your own free will and you get hurt, is it your own fault that you get hurt?
At this point, Donnie's adopted daughter, a beautiful girl of 16, sits down in Donnie's lap. He wraps his arms around her, continuing his debate.
I would say a lot of it is. I can't say what my kids would say.
A grandson goes around the table, guest by guest, politely asking each whether they want strawberries with their ice cream.
You can get sick, Mike Tritico tells Donnie. I have been sick. And Mother Nature in Bayou Din is sick. In fact, it has been made sick by people who think like you do. And it's hard to get to a place where people feel safe enough to live creative lives when the decisions of important leaders are based on bravado.
The room is quiet. The two are approaching a real showdown. Mike continues,
so what if you're a guy like me who tries to find out the cause and effect of the EDC spill, and the companies won't say, and the state government won't say? So through the Freedom of Information Act, you receive 3,000 pages, redacted, blacked out, so that you still don't know the truth about the spill. Why should we have to settle for that? And how could it be my own fault that I got hurt or killed?
Donnie,
if risk is to be reduced at all, it should be done by regular people themselves. I've taken some risks when I was a logger with Willie Baldwin, and we built log bridges, chained them together, and drove over the bridge with a big load of logs. That was a risk, and one guy did get hurt. You have to live with risk. But it's real people, not the government, that should be telling us what is or isn't too risky.
Mike,
but you need some people who make it their business to know more about very complicated things, so that all available information can be brought to bear on complex issues.
Donnie,
but citizens can do the job. Some citizens complained about a smelly asphalt pit, and it got closed.
Mike,
but what if the pit owners hadn't agreed to close it?
Donnie,
then get a lawyer.
And so the debate continues. Everyone now returns with second helpings of strawberries and ice cream, the women handing around coffee. Tritico feels that Donnie is an unwitting mouthpiece for the chemical companies. He embraces their right to take risks with our lives. And Donnie, while conceding Mike's greater information on the matter, feels Tritico speaks for the regulators, who would turn society into a giant block of cement. Through the years, their dispute has continued on the Internet. Once, after Mike arranged for a professor to give a lecture in Lake Charles on global warming, the talk was reported in an online news article. Mike spotted a discrediting comment accusing the professor of propagating lies. The comment was anonymous, but Tritico said,
"Oh, that's probably Donnie."
Sister Faye and the other women, now seated at one end of the men's table, turn the conversation to government welfare. Out-of-wedlock births, addiction, and the reluctance to work for your living. Women on welfare have 6 or 7 children, Faye notes. The consensus around the table is that the government could support 1 out-of-wedlock child, but not the remaining 5 or 6, since the woman in question should have learned her lesson. The debate between Mike and Donnie echoes a larger finding from a 1997 study of 400 workers in a Louisiana chemical plant that processed materials that were carcinogenic, mutagens, and flammable. Researchers John Bauer and J. Timmons Roberts of Brown University asked workers, "How often are you exposed to dangerous chemicals on the job? And do you worry about exposure to these dangerous chemicals?" Worry about exposure, the researchers reported, was only loosely related to actual exposure. Hourly crafts workers, men such as Donnie McCorkadale, worried less than you'd think they would, given their exposure. Managers and clerical workers worried more. For example, 50% of hourly crafts workers said they were always or often exposed to dangerous chemicals on the job, but only 40% said they worried about it. A higher proportion felt exposed than were worried. Among managers and professionals, a smaller proportion, 10%, said they were exposed, but a higher proportion, 20%, said they worried about it. Relative to their actual exposure, workers worried less and managers worried more. Women in the study were more likely to listen for warnings, take them seriously, and act with precaution than men were. And minorities did so more than whites. When asked about a long list of risks, white males stood out from all other groups as being less likely to see risk. Maybe Donnie was more like the white male crafts worker, and Mike Tritico was more like the manager. The two men also differed in what they thought ought to be done about exposure. They assigned honor differently. Exposed to danger in some of his jobs, Donnie tended to stand brave against it and to honor bravery. Less exposed to danger, Tritico wanted to reduce the need for bravery. Donnie said, in essence, "I'm strong, you're strong, Mother Nature is strong, we can take it." In this way, he resembled the cowboy. Tritico valued the precautionary principle and said, in essence, "The real strength we need is to stand up to industry and the almighty dollar." In the past, Mike had taken risks of a different sort himself. He had heard of a scientist who had testified at a public meeting, pointing out the dangers of a proposed dredging project. Angry workers felt his testimony would lose them work, and after the late-night meeting, they ran his car off the road. Mike himself went to the same meeting hall weeks later to warn against the same project in the presence of the same glaring men. In the end, other men offered to escort him home. One could be brave without being a cowboy. What was life like in the plants themselves, I wondered. Were they governed by Donnie's cowboy perspective or Mike Tritico's precautionary principle? One safety inspector for Axiall, which had an enormous explosion in 2013 and again in 2014, had the job of trying to reduce the risk of accidents. The young man climbed towers and squeezed under machines to check pipes and valves and attach small red flags to pipes that needed replacing or valves tightening. Operators didn't like him coming around because each red flag meant extra work, he said. Some waved him away. "No, not today." Then he said, "They would gang up. I'd have to call their boss, and they hated that. So when they saw me, they'd say, 'Here comes Big Brother.'" It was a stressful job. On hearing this story, a man hired as a corporate industrial hygienist tasked with sampling acid mist in the battery charging area in a Ford battery plant, recounted this. To set up the air monitors, I had to wear a respirator. Staff asked me to take it off, since it might make workers who saw me with it on worry about the ill effect of the air on them. But they needn't have worried. Some of the guys started to taunt me, the corporate sissy who couldn't tough it out like they did. But when they laughed at me, I could see their teeth were visibly eroded by exposure to sulfuric acid mist. Not all cowboys are male, of course, and they hold many kinds of jobs. Among those I talked with, one was a state administrator, another an accountant, and several were homemakers. If the state of Louisiana itself had been seated at Brother Cappy and Sister Faye's dinner table, it might have taken Donnie's side. For in Louisiana, as mentioned, it is legal to buy a frozen daiquiri with the lid snapped on, straw to the side, tape over the hole, at a drive-by shop. It's legal to gamble and to carry a loaded gun into a bar on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. In these ways, Louisiana is a cowboy kind of state. To Donnie, the cowboy expressed high moral virtue, equating creativity with daring, the stuff of great explorers, inventors, generals, winners. Donnie honored the capacity to take risk and face fear. He could take hard knocks like a man. He could endure. Janice Areno had accommodated environmental pollution through loyalty to job-providing industries and the party she identified with them. Jackie Tabor had accommodated it because it was the sacrifice we make for capitalism. Donnie accommodated out of respect for bravery. Each expressed a deep story self. Like nearly everyone I spoke with, Donnie was not one to think of himself as a victim. That was the language of the poor me's asking for government handouts. The very word victim didn't sit right. In fact, they were critical of liberal-sounding talk of victimhood. But I began to wonder whether the white, older conservatives in southwest Louisiana, team player, worshiper, cowboy, were not themselves victims. They were braving the worst of an industrial system, the fruits of which liberals enjoyed from a distance in their highly regulated and cleaner blue states. Further disagreements were later brought to the Sunday dinner table of Brother Cappy and Sister Faye. Accepting 20,000 Syrian refugees, as President Obama proposed? No, comes the chorus around the table. Yes, says Mike Tritico. Who for president? Donald Trump, Donnie says. No, says Mike. Issue by issue, so it goes. Meanwhile, as we scraped the last delicious morsels from our dessert plates, no one had said no to the strawberries, and Brother Cappy had never reached for the Vidalia onion, Tritico makes a last try to bait his adversarial friend.
So, Donnie, how do you feel about crossing the I-10 bridge?
If my kids weren't with me, Donnie answers, smiling, I drive fast. 13. The Rebel, a team loyalist with a new cause. Handmade signs bob and lurch above the heads of the sparse crowd. Clean water for Baton Rouge. Friends of Lake Penure. Clean water for clean seafood. Oil companies, fix what you broke. A rotund musician dressed in loose purple pants, a striped shirt, and a white fedora sits with his washboard, waiting to start his three-person Cajun band. A protester walks about dressed as a large brown pelican. Organizers had tried to rouse interest, but in a city of 230,000 on this sunny Saturday, only about 150 have shown up. It was at this rally on the front steps of the State House in Baton Rouge that I'd first met Mike Schaff. He was dressed in a bright yellow T-shirt with Bayou Corn Sinkhole printed on the front. With a protective arm, he had brought forward a victim to the microphone to speak before the gathering, but it was he who spoke with tears in his voice.
582 days this woman has been out of her home, he told the crowd, and there were over 300 victims just like her.
Since the disaster, Mike had been transformed into an activist. He didn't want others to go through the same ordeal. How, I wondered, did his new activism alter his feelings about the market-loving, government-hating Tea Party he so strongly embraced? Mike had described himself as a water baby.
When I was about 3, back when we lived on the Armalese plantation, my daddy used to take me with him crawfishing. He'd set the traps in a nearby swamp. Then he'd put me in a plastic tub and pull it along in the water as he waded through the water, emptying the traps. I loved it.
Now, as a 64-year-old man, Mike had a modest home facing a canal issuing onto this glorious bayou that was the paradise he had yearned to retire to, a home on the water. Sitting alone at the kitchen table of his empty house a year and a half after the disaster, and sometime after the rally, with cardboard boxes packed, the crack in his living room floor a reminder of recent earthquakes, a gas monitor in his garage, and a wary eye on feral cats, Mike had begun to write letters concerning key bills to members of the Louisiana legislature.
April 24, 2014. Friends, supporters, and distinguished senators. My name is Mike Schaff. My desire was to live the rest of my days here and in my last will and testament to be able to turn over this precious jewel to my survivors. Instead, the only legacy that I will be able to pass on are the countless tears that have been shed, the disrespect that we have been shown by both Texas Brine and our state officials themselves, and the cruel reality that despite hopes of a short-lived incident, the fact is that this tragedy can never truly be remedied. Mike Schaff, resident of Paradise Stolen, Bayou Corn, Louisiana.
He was speaking for Senate Bill 209, which would require companies to give victims the replacement value of lost homes within 180 days of an accident. The language of the bill was dry. Seated in the Louisiana legislature were many oil men, owners, past company employees, investors, and recipients of campaign donations, and the bill was tabled. On another issue, Texas Brine had asked for permission from the state to flush toxic wastewater into the sinkhole it had caused, and Mike Schaff wrote the secretary of the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality to object.
To Ms. Hatch, discarding polluted water back into the sinkhole is akin to allowing BP to skim the oil from the Gulf of Mexico and dump it back into the Gulf.
And so it went, bill after bill, and speech after speech, for now he had become, still resisting the term, an environmental activist. By August of 2015, he had written 50 letters to state and federal officials. He had appeared in 20 local television interviews, 15 print interviews, and 5 national and international television interviews.
This is the closest I've come to being a tree hugger, he tells me with a rueful smile.
After the sinkhole disaster, Mike had helped gather neighbors in a desperate circle of self-help. During that meeting, someone suggested inviting General Russell Honoré. Mike recalled imagining the general wouldn't come out for such a small group, but when the general responded immediately, something new emerged. The Green Army. As the general was to tell me in a separate interview,
as soon as I drove home from that first meeting and thought about Mike, it occurred to me he would be great to work with, and we needed to start something big. The Green Army then became an umbrella organization for many small groups, such as Baton Rouge Aquifer Protection, Restore Louisiana Now, and the Lower Mississippi River Keepers. One that could speak with the serious authority they would need to stand up to oil and the politicians who wanted to gut the EPA. A lot of people think the environment is a soft, feminine issue, the general mused. We need mics.
Don't be a cowboy in enduring pollution, he seemed to say. Be a cowboy fighting it. But each time Mike rose before an audience to speak about Bayou corn, he placed his hand over his mouth, delivered a few sentences in a cracked voice.
I've had a rough time because all the emotions rushed back over me, as they have tended to do lately,
he told me about a talk he gave to a Tea Party group.
The wound is still so fresh.
Mike was brought up to admire cowboys.
Southern men don't cry, he tells me, and I haven't been much of a weeper.
Still, he is disconcerted to discover himself choking up while speaking to the public about the disaster.
I pray one day I'll be able to speak with no tears, just anger, he tells me.
Before the sinkhole, Mike had worked all his life for oil, an ardent conservative Republican, and since 2009, an unconflicted Tea Party loyalist. He was a free market man, he told me. But how free were people when companies were free to make methane gas bubble in your front yard? What was the Tea Party answer to that? This was the question before him. Mike felt he had patiently stood in line too long for the American dream. He had worked hard for a boss and company he liked. But like the 90% of Americans who saw no rise in income, Mike was caught in the long, dreary wait. He took offense at certain remarks rumored to have been made by a pro-Texas brine wife of a retired Exxon engineer who lived in Bayou Corn.
She's one of 30 or 40 owners of fancy-dancy homes on the other side of the highway, Mike remarked.
And she let slip that our housing was substandard. The homeowners association on our side of the road allows trailers on house lots. On their side, they don't. He felt he'd done okay, but was vulnerable to nasty jibes like that. And more wealth felt within reach. Mike twice remarked on millionaires in the local area. One was the heavily bearded star of the reality television show Duck Dynasty, who combined conservative views with Cajun frontier skills. The other was a short, bearded man in t-shirt, blue jeans, and tennis shoes standing in the back row at a meeting of sinkhole victims with Texas brine, which I was attending with Mike. He introduced himself as a poor man, but the crowd tittered knowingly. No, he dressed poor, but he was rich. And there were others around like him, Mike said, with more money than him. From a shotgun home on the Armalese sugarcane plantation to a college education, a professional career, and a home on Bayou Corn, Mike had done well. But he didn't seem sure it was well enough. Mike loves to fish, boat, and watch the outstretched wings of the egrets, white ibis, and roseate spoonbills. His email handle is Swampman. But through the years, he found little daylight time for any of this.
Hey, I haven't seen a month's vacation since I was 22, he says ruefully.
As an estimator, he had calculated the size, strength, heat and pressure withstanding properties and cost of materials needed to build enormous oil storage tanks and drilling platforms. He had been given only 1 week off a year for the first 5 years, sick time and vacation combined. For the next five, he was given 2 weeks off, and after 10 years, three. For his entire working life, Mike had yearned for daylight leisure to spend in nature. So, on the verge of retirement, he could hardly wait. Time with his new wife, time fishing and hunting, time with his grandchildren. Then came the sinkhole. After the last church service in Bayou Corn, in which the community sang Amazing Grace in French, his neighbors and friends scattered to camper trucks, motels, and relatives' guest rooms, leaving Bayou Corn a ghost town encroached on by 32 acres of toxic sludge. All the fun times they'd had, at crawfish boils and fish fries, at Miss Eddie's birdhouse, the local Mardi Gras parade of bayou corn hookers, all gone. Mike had tried to get the loss behind him, but 3 years later, he is still saying, "Bayou corn will always be home." In his new activism, Mike's long background in oil became a great asset. He knew the geology. He knew the economics. He knew the local lay of the land. He'd gained first-hand knowledge of dangerous chemicals. As a child, he had crouched in the sugarcane field to watch the Piper Cub crop dusters fly low, their wheels nearly leafing through the tops of the cane stalks. After the pilot had sprayed DDT clouds and started to rise at the end of the row, Mike would pop up from the cane into the pesticide cloud to watch the plane turn for another pass. He knew about unawareness. But what was new for Mike was a close-up view of the politics, especially the attitude toward the environment expressed by Republican Governor Bobby Jindal. Closer to home, Mike found himself wedged uneasily between two groups. On matters of government and tax, he was 100% with the Louisiana Tea Party. Corrupt state officials had seemed to cut in ahead of him, as in the deep story. They were nothing like the self-abnegating nuns he thought public servants should resemble. He had low respect for most of the Louisiana regulatory officials, and in theory, little for their federal counterparts. But in one instance, when he doubted state officials who claimed to detect no oil in the bayou corn ground, Mike called for the more reliable feds to double-check. But now, Mike's new environmental comrades were 99% liberals, with their own different deep story, as I'll suggest later.
"I'd be okay with 70-30, he says.
He agreed with them that Louisiana
gave out drilling permits like candy.
He agreed with them on fracking and on getting industry to repair the coast their actions had destroyed. He agreed on alternative energy. Louisiana was 42nd out of 50 states on that one. He didn't agree with liberals on funding Head Start, Pell College grants, Obamacare, or Social Security. And that was fine. But in the back of his mind, Mike wanted to add the environment to the agenda of the Tea Party. How tough a sell would that be? He wanted to find out. The disaster before the sinkhole. Disasters could occur, get forgotten, and occur again. Like Harold and Annette Areno, Mike was now a rememberer. And the challenge he faced was how to make bayou corn the last accident of its kind, one everyone would remember. In 1980, an even more disastrous drilling accident occurred in Lake Panure, over 100 miles west of bayou corn's sinkhole. Texaco had drilled a hole in the bottom of the lake and punctured an underlying salt dome. The resulting whirlpool had sucked down 2 drilling platforms, 11 barges, 4 flatbed trucks, a tugboat, acres of soil, trees, trucks, a parking lot, and an entire 65-acre botanical garden. Miraculously, no one died. Days later, 9 barges popped back up. 2 were never found. One man fishing in the lake that fateful day had tied his motorboat to a tree, but the tree itself began to move toward the vortex. Noticing it, the man quickly untied his boat from the moving tree and roared away at top speed. But years later, a memory-softening documentary appeared about the Lake Panure disaster. Narrated in a laconic tone that placed these events in the distant past and focused on amusing ironies, the film, produced by the local Chamber of Commerce, seemed to relax the viewer. The narrator expressed gratitude that no humans died, of course, but he avoided blame of Texaco and focused instead on the small drill bit that seemed to have punctured the dome by itself. The film ends with an image of birds flying over the placid lake, and a tourist bureau website inviting tourists to visit the site where the accident happened. In fact, a video on the disaster has become an attraction in the Rip Van Winkle Gardens brochure.
Watch a salt mine swallow a lake at Rip Van Winkle Gardens on Jefferson Island. Then tour Rip's Rookery, where roseate spoonbills nest